Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, author and educator Kim John Payne. Next week, he'll travel from his home in New Hampshire to talk about building kids' resilience to bullying, teasing, and subtle non-inclusion. We'll talk to him about that. Up first, the Dayton mayoral primary is less than 2 weeks away. Independent incumbent Gary Leitzel is facing two Democratic challengers, Nan Whaley and A.J. Wagner. Last week, WYSO News Director Emily McCord spoke with all three candidates to find out what issues were important to them. We begin with Mayor Gary Leitzel.
I'm speaking with Mayor Leitzel. He's running for re-election for the mayoral race in the primary in May. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why do you deserve a second term as mayor?
Well, it's not a case of whether I deserve it. It's the fact that thousands of people have asked me to do it. I always tell people I didn't do this the first time because it was about me. It was about I was angry. I was frustrated. And I saw my city stagnating. And I felt that if I didn't stand up and at least make an effort to change the way they think at City Hall – then I couldn't guarantee someone else would do it. So I did it. I think people are happy with the direction we're moving in. And a lot of people were asking me if I was going to run again, and I would ask them how they felt because I've always said that this wasn't something that I absolutely had to do. I've got a pretty busy life and things I can do on other things. And they were all unequivocally said, yes, we want you to run again. So I threw my hat in the ring and said I'll do it again. But I've also made it very clear that I will limit my budget.
Limit your budget to what?
$10,000.
For the campaign?
For the entire campaign. The first time round, I spent $17,600 against something like $160,000 that was spent against me. And after last year's presidential election where we just saw outrageous spending by both sides, I think I believe I represent about 80% of the population and can say that we're tired of that. And I'm willing to lay down a budget – line that says, you know, the job pays $45,000 a year. Now, I've always said you shouldn't have to pay more than 1 year's salary to get elected. But just to prove my point, I'm willing to limit that to a quarter of my salary, which is still a little bit more than half of what I spent the first time. And I challenged the other candidates to do the same, and of course they've declined. But three of us who are independent candidates are willing to do it. David Israeli and David Greer are running for city commission. And we're basically – we've come together to prove this point that I believe the time has come where money needs to come out of politics, and we're willing here in Dayton, Ohio, to prove a point. If we win, it's going to send a message to the entire country that it can be done.
What issue is most important to you when it comes to the problems facing the city, and what do you plan on doing about it?
Well, the two biggest issues that come up again are – it's always going to be jobs and our neighborhoods. And – I can tell you this. You know, I was president of my neighborhood association. I was the chair of the Southeast Priority Board before I came mayor. And those neighborhoods that have neighborhood associations fare much better than those that have none. And I think if we want a long-term solution to saving our neighborhoods, we have to get any neighborhood that doesn't have a neighborhood association organized to create one, even if it's just a group of block clubs. People who care, people who are responsible for where they live, and it kind of radiates out, and all of a sudden a neighborhood association is formed, and people start coming together and taking care of some of the problems. But you know, we have 65 neighborhoods in the city of Dayton, and at least a third of them are exceptional. You know, people kind of blanket Dayton as a bad place, but we have some very, very beautiful neighborhoods. However, we have a handful that are fairly blighted. And those neighborhoods that are blighted have not had neighborhood associations probably in 15, 20 years.
You've been criticized in the past for your approach to the mayoral role, for example, working part-time or you know, taking time off to do some home repairs, mm-hmm. for things like that. What do you say to critics of your view of the role of the mayor?
Well, the job is part-time. Okay, it's in the charter as a part-time job. We're basically supposed to be a board of directors of nonpartisan citizens who oversee a strong city manager form of government. And the manager has the access to the entire resources of the city at his fingertips. We don't. I work about 36 to 40 hours a week part time. I mean, no joke. I get up in the morning. The first 2 hours of every day, I'm dealing with emails, responses, and things like that. but I don't go to the office. I have a phone at home. I mean, I was self-employed before I did this. I mean, I don't need an office to go to be seen at, to have meetings. A lot of my meetings with citizens are at coffee shops, at restaurants. But what I have been told is I am the most accessible member of that entire city commission. If you contact my office on a Monday or Tuesday and request to have a meeting with me, it's very likely that by Thursday or Friday you're sitting in front of me. And the reason that happens is because I treat it as a part-time job, I leave big blocks of time open for that kind of stuff. The other thing, too, is you know, I use Facebook a lot and people send me messages and they'll tell me that they send me something on Facebook. I respond. If they call the office on the phone, it's unlikely they'll get me. And I don't have a cell phone. I will not carry a cell phone because the only people that want to get hold of me are the media. And I only want to talk about the good things that are happening. So that's pretty much what I'd say to the critics. I mean, you say I don't work full time. I say 40 hours part time's plenty. And if I take some time off to fix up my house, I'm doing a good thing in Dayton.
WYSO's Emily McCord speaking with Mayor Gary Lightsel. Lightsel is being challenged by Nan Whaley. Whaley has served on the Dayton City Commission since 2005 and has the nomination of the Democratic Party.
How do you define the role as mayor? What is that going to look like if you are elected?
Well, you know, if I'm elected mayor, I will be a full-time mayor. I think that the city deserves that, and it deserves someone that really uses that position to really advocate for both the city and the region and make sure that we have a place at the table both statewide and nationally. So that's the role I would definitely carve out. And then also, you know, making sure that citizens' needs are heard and that they feel like they have a voice and a place into the mayor's office.
So, but the mayor's position is a part-time job by definition, as I understand it.
It's considered part-time, but so is the commission, frankly, and I've treated it pretty much as a full-time job as well. And so I think, you know, for me, I really love public service and love really getting to talk to people, and there's a lot of work to do in Dayton, and so that's what I would commit to do.
How would your mayor tenure compare to what's happening right now under Mayor Gary Lightsel? How would you make it different?
Well, I have really strong relationships with the city commission, and I'm proud that the other three commissioners have all endorsed me for this position. You know, I don't do anything alone, and I know that it's about collaborations and partnerships. And so I think we'd really work hard to make sure that we use each person's assets and relationships with other folks to really move the city forward. That's one way. And then also, you know, I think we need to have a vision and a plan that moves Dayton forward. And so we've done that with the roadmap for Dayton's future. We've put it on our website at nanwhaley.com, really focusing in on our asset-based development with job creation and making sure we create jobs. We know that when people have jobs, a lot of other problems go away. They can get housing easily. They can take care of their kids. They pay attention to education of their children. So, you know, we really think that jobs is the key for Dayton's future. And then also making sure that our neighborhoods, a focus on neighborhoods, especially with blight. You know, I've been a leader in making sure that Dayton gets a good amount of money from both the state and federal government on taking down some extreme blight in our community.
And what about neighborhoods? What's your plan for restoring them?
Yeah, we've unveiled a neighborhood plan, and that's something I've been working a lot as city commissioner. And really, we've developed a strategy called the Green and Gold Strategy, which I'm really proud of. And it's basically talking about how, you know, we have a housing stock that's around for 250,000 people when the height of Dayton's population was that in 1972. And some of that those properties aren't viable and they're not really livable. And so we have to get those properties down because it's really hurting the person that's living next door. You know, that person that's living next door is paying their taxes, living next to that blight every day, has to worry about it being safe or not safe. And we have to get those properties down. So that's been a big focal point of my commission tenure. I'm really proud of the work we've done from getting money from Move Ohio Forward in the state, or if it's federal dollars that we've advocated from our federal delegation. Congressman Turner just co-sponsored a bill that would allow for some of the mediation money that has not been spent in the state to be moved onto this blighted properties. But we have to know we need help, and we can't do that alone. And so we really need someone in the mayor's seat that's advocating and using the bully pulpit and using relationships with state and federal folks to get those dollars. Then we also have to work in our neighborhoods to have conversations about what it means to be less dense. And there's great opportunities with that, too, because quite frankly, some of the houses that were put, you know, in the boom of the 50s and 60s of Dayton were built a little too close and weren't really the best design. And so I think we have a great opportunity to redesign our neighborhoods. We've tried some of that in some of our neighborhoods. And I think that's gone pretty well. And then finally, we have to recognize that we have 65 unique neighborhoods in the city of Dayton, and they have different values and different ways they want to live. And so it's really important that the city listen to what the neighborhood wants and try to work on what's realistic for the neighborhood to do to move forward. I think that's really, really a key point. There's not a one-size-fits-all answer for our neighborhoods in the city of Dayton.
One thing that's come up during this mayor's race, Mayor Lightsel had issued a challenge to all the mayoral candidates to keep campaign spending under $10,000 mm-hmm. as a cap. Both you and A.J. Wagner decided not to take him up on that. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think, number one, he's the sitting mayor, so it's an advantage for him to challenge a cap because he does get a lot more media play and a lot more attention. When there's an issue, they go to the mayor, and he can choose to take that media or not take that media. So, number one, it's a little self-serving to issue a cap as the sitting mayor. And secondly, you know, more importantly, I think when we are deciding to run this race and how we wanted to tell the citizens of Dayton about the future of Dayton, we believe Dayton is a first-class city and it needs a first-class race. And so that's going to take more than $10,000 to communicate with the citizens of Dayton about the future. And it's an important position. It's an important position not only for the city, but for the region as a whole. And so, you know, to have arbitrary amounts declared by one of the candidates, I just don't think is something that is really fair.
Emily McCord speaking with Dayton City Commissioner Nan Whaley about her run for Dayton mayor. Also challenging Gary Lightsel for the mayoral ticket, A.J. Wagner. In his conversation with Emily, he spoke about what leadership means to him.
You know, a lot of people have called over the years for broader leadership for the whole region. And the mayor of Dayton kind of could be that. But my view of it is that we have tremendous leadership all around our communities, and that the role of mayor isn't necessarily to lead, but it's to kind of bring along those who other leaders to energize them and motivate them and get them involved in the community, because one person can't do it by themselves. So it's collaborating. It's bringing people together who can develop collaborations, can develop programs, can develop ideas together so that they together lead into the community. And it's not me or the mayor that will do that except by virtue of bringing people together. The leadership's already there. It just has to be focused and motivated.
So what distinguishes you from the other mayoral candidates that are running, independent Gary Lightsel, who's current mayor,
right,
and Democratic challenger Nan Whaley?
Right. Mostly experience. I'm the old man. I've been 10 years as county auditor, 10 years as Montgomery County Court Judge, but I've also been a school teacher. I've been a banker. I've owned my own business. I've raised two beautiful children who are now middle-aged, they tell me. And it's all those kinds of experiences, I think, that can come to bear in a positive way on how you see things, how you think of things, how you envision solutions to problems, because you've seen other problems, especially when you've practiced law. You've seen a lot of problems, and you've seen solutions to those problems, both in the law and in other personal ways. And I think that my experience can come to bear on the city in ways that both Gary and Nan, who are good people, but who don't have the depth of experience that I have. And I think that's the difference.
Is there one problem that is at the heart of what you want to do for Dayton more than any other?
Probably I would prioritize the problems, but there are several that I want to attack. In fact, I've got a full schedule already lined up for when I become mayor. But it's got to start with the neighborhoods and housing. Even though we desperately need jobs, and that has to be part near the top also, we desperately need to change some things. But right at the top has to be the neighborhoods. They have been deteriorating at a rapid rate. And all you have to do is drive around Dayton for a while and you see falling down houses and peeling paint and tires and alleys. And you see so much decay that you've got to have a real concern for what's happening in the city.
So how do you stop that?
Well, you have to create new laws. You have to increase enforcement and you have to create new laws. Because of my experience as a judge and lawyer, I know that we can make laws that will help hold their feet to the fire. We're not going to win them all. We're not going to win all the battles. But right now, people can walk away from properties because nobody chases them. and we have to develop systems that chase them and hold them accountable. If you walk away from a property right now, you may that property will go into foreclosure and nobody will chase you. We have to make sure that when that property goes into foreclosure, we enforce the liens that come off of that property, enforce them against any other property that that owner has, so that they're forced at some point when they want to sell their properties to pay up and cover the city for the expenses that they have. But also it will tell them that they can't just walk away from each individual property. And so it's a process that we can make and we can create that will hold them more accountable than they've been held.
I do want to talk a little bit about the differences in particular between you and Democratic challenger Nan Whaley. You two are both Democrats, and I am curious. She has the endorsement of the Democratic Party, and you do not. What's the story there?
Well, first of all, I did not ask for the endorsement. I actually looked at this in two ways. Number one was if I wanted the endorsement, there was going to be a fight. It would be a big internal fight within the party. If I'm going to govern the city, I need the help of the Democratic Party, but I also need the help of the Republican Party. We don't need split parties. We don't need split communities. It won't work. It hasn't worked, and it won't work. And I thought, well, if I honor the charter, which is this is a nonpartisan race, if I honor the charter and turn down the endorsement, it avoids the split in the party, and I hope that's true. They can endorse Nan. I'll run on my own merit. And then I will – hopefully, when this is over, if I'm mayor, then we can pull the party back together because we haven't done serious damage to it. And we can pull the party back together. We can also, because of my nonpartisan stance, work closely with Republicans, work closely with independents to make sure that the whole community is focused and going in one direction.
WISO's Emily McCord speaking with mayoral candidate A.J. Wagner. You can find extended interviews with all three candidates on our website, wiso.org.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, you know, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies and see our show? Because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country, and I thought it'd be, you know, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait Wait Live in theaters on May 2nd.
Full details and theater listings are at the WISO website, wiso.org.
To find out what's going on around the Miami Valley, visit the Community Events Calendar at wiso.org. You can browse by date or by category, or subscribe to an RSS feed. You can even submit your own event, and you might hear it read live on the air. Visit wiso.org and click on Events.
Kim John Payne is the best-selling author of the much-quoted book Simplicity Parenting. Payne has done considerable anti-bullying work as well, reframing it as social inclusion. That work has become the official protocol for dealing with such issues in Great Britain. Kim will be coming to both Antioch College and Antioch University on May 8th and 9th. At Antioch College, he'll be leading a four-hour pre-conference workshop called Overcoming Social Overwhelm, Building Our Kids' Resilience to Bullying, Teasing, and Subtle Non-Inclusion. Then at Antioch University Midwest on the 9th, he'll deliver a keynote address for the symposium on Making Visible the Invisible, in which he'll talk about what simplicity parenting is and why we need it now more than ever. I spoke with him by phone last week.
One of the things, having worked with bullying and teasing issues for three decades now, is one of the things I'm starting to see is that whilst bullying and teasing are devastating issues, and any parent educator knows that, one of the things that I'm seeing come up more and more is the cumulative and very negative effects of subtle non-inclusion. It's not as big as bullying and teasing. It tends to fly under the radar. And as such, can really build up quite a toxic charge. If a young person, if a child brings it up, you know, talks about it with an adult, teacher, parent, I'll be talking about ways in which we can know that that's the tip of the iceberg, which I know is a terrible cliche, but it's actually true. When a kid brings up that they're being excluded, we tend to, in some ways, dismiss it a little easier than if they talk to us about they're being bullied or cyberbullied, because a lot of us are onto that now. We tend to sit up straight a little more and take a little more notice. But with subtle non-inclusion that goes on day after day after day, we can normalize that very easily. We can say, you know, boys will be boys, or that's the way girls are today, and, well, maybe he's a bit sensitive. And there's all kinds of ways of normalizing it. But my concern is that this builds up and builds up and builds up over time, and can have just as serious impact on a child's life as more upfront bullying can have. So we're going to be addressing the effects of that, what the warning signs are, and how to work with a child or a teen that's reporting in that subtle non-inclusion.
Aren't you up against a bigger problem than just kids? Because quite often, aren't children just emulating the actions that they're taught in their own environments?
Well, you know, one of the studies that was influential on me years ago was a study that showed that on one hand, just over 80% of all aggression, all aggressive behavior, repeated aggression in schools, is actually learned in the home and then plays itself out in the more complex social environment of the school. We really have to work as a team together with the parents, and if parents can be so influential in a kid's life in terms of negativity and negative social behavior, then, well, they can be just as positive. It's the same thing as true. And over the years, I've worked very, very closely with parents in all the schools that I work with that question of how can you build up your child's social resiliency? How can you model good behavior, good problem solving, and particularly problem solving around social difficulties? And that doesn't have to be, it's not fancy stuff, you know, it's pretty basic. It's very basic. And how can we be modeling that, engaging with our kids in that, engaging in conversation with them about that? And if we're willing to do that, some of the sort of two or three real basic things, then the resiliency of our children in schools jumps up. They're much less likely to be picked on, and when they are picked on, they're much more likely to come and tell you about it, and you, therefore, are much more likely to have the relationship with them to be able to problem solve with them. It's just a very, very positive picture, and we'll be talking about how to do that.
You mentioned that children in those situations, the kids who are perhaps doing the bullying, are trying to control their surroundings. And they've also been given a lot of power with the internet and social media and networking. And it's been suggested that even adults are not prepared for what we've been handed. And so kids are in a particularly critical situation, I guess, with regard to all of this. And let's touch on that. There are a lot of cases, as you mentioned earlier, about the rise of cyberbullying.
Yeah, you know, and it's a good way to put it, Jerry, is that they've got a lot of power, and power that they don't know how to use. And any parent has a sort of a gut, I think, an instinctive reaction to that one of, well, we've got to teach them how to use the power. Firstly, we've got to dial it back a little bit. So, and then secondly, we've got to teach them to use the power that they have. We've got to only give them the amount of power they can handle at their developmental stage. And that partly is why I'm a really big fan of strongly limiting kids' access to screen media. And in a sense, I'm a little counterculture there. You know, 15, 20 years ago, I was counterculture when I was mentioning slowing things down, dialing it back. Now there's just hundreds of thousands of parents all around the world doing that, and I'm afraid the same thing's happening again. I'm I'm calling for a really severe restricting of kids' access to screen media, to phones, to computers. It's more power than they can handle, and they're proving that. They're showing that to us by the way they're using that. But again, it's just become so ubiquitous that when I talk with parents about you know, delaying kids' free use of cell phones until well into their teens, they look at me as if I'm crazy and say, "What do you mean? Not give my kid a cell phone until they're 12 or 13? Every child has got one." And I'm saying, "Yep." And look at the problems it's causing. So there's two things here, really, Jerry. One is that if a parent really insists on giving a child access to digital technology very, very young, then I'll work with that a little bit with them and say, well, how can you really dial back the use of it? How can you monitor the use of it much more carefully? And how can you, in a sense, move into that parenting space with digital devices? What can you do to reestablish the parenting space in that and not step back saying, hey, that's just the way things are these days, because it's not healthy? We wouldn't do that with their diets. We wouldn't do that with their sleeping, waking patterns. We wouldn't do that with any other aspect of their lives. That somehow, as a society, we've bought into the fact that we are powerless when it comes to kids' digital devices and what they're messaging to each other, the way they're using Facebook. And a lot of parents now are saying, hey, this is simply not okay. We've got to move back into that parenting space with digital technology.
I don't want to end on a negative note, but I do want to say that when you look at the things that children go through, often it does prepare them for later in life. So is there a compromise between what you're seeking to do and kind of the average things that kids need to go through to grow and learn and find themselves?
Yeah, no, great question. I don't want to buy into what I call harmony addiction, where every day has to be this wonderful day, and if anything bad happens, then it's not okay. Conflict is in really vital part of childhood. Learning how to handle conflict is hugely important, because when you learn how to handle conflict, you learn a lot about yourself, and you learn a lot about yourself and how to navigate the social world. I'm not at all abdicating that there should be no conflict, because that's not going to happen. What I'm talking about is that conflict is a huge part of the way kids come to know themselves. In a sense, you could almost call it like a modern rite of passage. It's rites of passage for thousands of years have been helping kids understand who they are, all those traditional ceremonies or the church some of those rituals are still alive, but most kids don't go through that anymore. And so what I'm suggesting is that conflict is a really, really big part of how kids come to understand a little bit more about who they are and how they work within groups. Now, rites of passage have always had elders. They've always had people helping them through for thousands of years. There have been people in the town, in the village, in the church, whether it's in Africa, in America, wherever it is, there have been adults stepping up, helping kids through the changes that they experience as they grow up. And what we'll be talking about is how do we take that kind of eldering that's been going on for thousands of years, and what's our role now in modern society? Because kids still need the guidance. They still will come into conflict. They still will come into conflict with others, and they'll even come into internal conflicts with themselves and feel a little lost and not know what to do. All that's normal. But also what's normal is adults stepping up and being able to help in a sensible way, help our kids go through that process, and that's crucial.
I've been speaking with Kim John Payne. He is the author of Simplicity Parenting and the Games Children Play. He is also on the faculty at Antioch University, New England in Keene, New Hampshire. Mr. Payne, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
It's a pleasure, Jerry. Great to be with you.
You can find more of my interview with Kim John Payne on our website, wyso.org. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests. And thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. We are a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, we're down by the riverside, listening to tales of steamboat captains and fishermen, traveling to the headwaters of the mighty Mississippi, and gliding downstream on the Belle of Louisville. Plus music and memories from Al Green, Johnny Cash, and Aaron Neville. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, 91.3 WYSO.